The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, a meteorite that struck the Earth more than 3 billion years ago might have acted like a giant fertilizer bomb for life on the blue planet. We'll learn about a new national study that may lead to a new affordable treatment for Alzheimer's disease. And officials are celebrating a national hub for semiconductor research. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. More than 3 billion years ago, a giant meteorite struck the Earth. The space rock, nicknamed the S2 Impactor, may have had a role in fertilizing early life on Earth. To learn more about the world-altering explosion, I spoke with Harvard researcher Nadia Draben. Dr. Draben, an assistant professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences, is an author of a new study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
So I always describe myself as an early Earth geologist. So that means I'm basically interested in anything that relates to the early Earth from shortly after its formation to about 3 billion years ago. And it's a really fascinating time period to be working in because there's a lot of really fundamental questions that we haven't been able to answer yet. So that includes, you know, when did life first evolve? You know, how did it evolve? And then, of course, how was that affected by giant meteorite impacts during that time period?
I am familiar with the stories about the meteorite that killed the dinosaurs, but this is something that is much bigger and happened much earlier. So what can you tell me about this meteorite and why were you interested in digging more into it and learning about it?
Yeah, so I was really interested in learning more about this meteorite simply because we know that during the early evolution of life, there was a much higher impact flux. So meaning that, you know, when Earth first formed, there was still a lot of debris in space colliding with Earth. And then through time, the impact flux slowly declined. So what we know is that, you know, life evolved at that time, but we don't really know how it was affected by giant meteorite impacts. So this was one of the first studies really trying to look at the rock record, right, to really see, you know, what evidence do we have for changes in the environment and how that affected life at that time period. To tell you a little bit more about the meteorite impact, so the S2 meteorite was a carbonaceous chondrite. So in that sense, it was very similar to the one that led to the extinction of the dinosaurs. So that one is called the Chicxulub-Bolide. However, they're very, very different in size. So the Chicxulub-Bolide that led to the extinction of the dinosaurs was about perhaps 10 kilometers in diameter, versus the one that I studied, the S2 bolide or impactor, was between 40 and 60 kilometers in diameter. So now what's important here is that, you know, this translates to a much bigger mass. So in terms of mass, the S2 impactor that I studied was between 50 and 200 times bigger than the one that killed the dinosaurs.
What was Earth like 3 billion years ago?
Yeah, that's a really great question, and that's something I'm trying to address also in other aspects of my research. But essentially, you have to imagine Earth being just a very different planet back then. So firstly, Earth was essentially a water world. So there were very few continents sticking above sea level, and perhaps there were a few volcanic islands. One of the consequences of that is that there was very little nutrients in the oceans back then because, you know, important elements like phosphorus, they're being, you know, taken from land masses and they're like weathered and eroded and flushed into the oceans. However, we do know that there was life at that time. It was probably very simple. So think about microbes. But because of the lack of nutrients and other aspects, it probably was just much less abundant than it is today.
So you said that this meteorite, this S2 impactor, was 200 times bigger than the one that killed the dinosaurs. That's pretty hard to imagine. If you were to visualize that, what would it possibly look like?
So one comparison that I have often seen is that it means it would have been at least the size of 4 Mount Everest, if not bigger.
What was particularly special about the S2 impactor compared with maybe other things that were striking the Earth from space?
I don't know if this impact was significantly different in any way. So that's something that we are hoping to find out with future research. The reason I focused on the S2 meteorite impact, so that happened 3.26 billion years ago, was that the rocks were really well preserved, right? So as we are geologists, we go out into the field to collect samples. You know, you have to look for your best outcrops, for your best rock exposures, so that you can do this really careful centimeter by centimeter work, you know, across the impact layer.
So can we think of the meteorite striking Earth as if you throw a large rock into a pond, maybe on a much smaller scale, and when the rock hits the bottom of the pond and all the water comes back up and it stirs everything up off of the bottom of the pond? Is that essentially what happened with Earth's oceans at the time?
Yeah, you could imagine something along those lines. So because Earth was a water world back then, it's really likely that the impact hit, you know, an ocean basin. So if we imagine an ocean basin today, you know, where the water is maybe 3 kilometers thick, right? But we have an impactor that was 40 to 60 kilometers in diameter. So it basically would, you know, go through the entire water column and all that water would be splashing out.
And then because all of that sediment and all of the material that was on the bottom of the ocean was mixed up and stirred up into the ocean water, what effect did that have, do you believe, maybe on life forming on Earth?
Yeah, so not only was it really stirred out at the impact site, but it triggered a huge tsunami. Right. It's quite possible that tsunami was bigger than anything humans have ever seen. And this tsunami would really be traveling across the globe. So that means not only close to where the impact happened, but also really far away, we would still see evidence from this like major impact event. And that's exactly what we find in the rock record. We see evidence for the passage of an enormous tsunami wave. And this tsunami wave would have mixed up the ocean, but it would also have brought ripped up the ocean floor.
Is there evidence of that tsunami wave across the Earth as it is now, where you can see the same evidence in one part of the world as another on the other side of the world?
In theory, yes, but we don't know for sure. And this is because, you know, rocks as old as the ones that we are studying, they're incredibly rare. This is in part because, you know, today we have plate tectonics. That means rocks are constantly destroyed at plate margins. So that means that there's only very few areas of old rocks, and then even fewer areas where the rocks are really well preserved where we can do these types of studies. So the area in South Africa that we study is the only place that we have found this impact event so far.
What kind of nutrients did early microorganisms really need to thrive? And how could of this impact specifically support early life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's multiple different ways that the impactor supported life and, you know, probably allowed it to thrive. So that's firstly because a carbonaceous chondrite, so the type of impactor that we are that we have evidence for here, can contain actually quite a bit of phosphorus. So when you take, you know, the largest estimate for its size and like the largest amount of phosphorus that, you know, has been found in carbonaceous chondrites, that means up to several hundred gigatons of phosphorus. So when the impact hits, you know, the huge impactor as well as some of the rock that it hits are going to actually vaporize because you're releasing so much energy. So you're going to vaporize that material. It's going to form a rock vapor cloud. At the same time, you're creating a lot of dust that is being ejected from the crater site into the atmosphere. All of this is going to circle around the globe and essentially start raining out. So this material is going to be enriched in phosphorus, and that's exactly what we see in the rock record. So we all know phosphorus is a very essential nutrient for life, and we think that during the early Earth, the oceans were lacking in phosphorus. So now we've got this, you know, amount of phosphorus coming in that's really helpful for life. At the same time, what's happening is that the tsunami that's sweeping across the globe and mixing the water column is bringing water from the deep oceans that was really rich in iron to the surface. And that's also really beneficial for life, for microbial metabolisms back then.
So we've talked about the effects on the ocean and a massive tsunami traveling around the world as a result of this meteorite strike. But what were some of the other impacts, and were there any impacts that we might interpret as being damaging or having negative impacts on the Earth?
Yeah, so even for the S2 meteorite impact, there were some disastrous effects. So first, of course, you know, there's the tsunami that was released because of the impact. And then at the same time, right, with the bolide hitting Earth and so much material vaporizing, so much dust being put into the atmosphere, the skies actually turned dark, right? So very little light was able to penetrate, like, to the land surface into the oceans, which would have made, you know, photosynthesis really challenging. And then on top of that, because we are talking about such a big size of impactor, a lot of that kinetic energy, you know, of the meteorite as it's hitting Earth is transformed into heat, meaning that the atmosphere really started heating up. So by heating up, I mean, you know, above the boiling point of water, so that we actually find evidence that the uppermost layers of the ocean started boiling off. So that, of course, would have been really disastrous to any life that lived on land or, you know, in shallow waters and that relied on sunlight. On the other side, of course, any other organisms, right, that could have moved into deeper layers of the oceans, and they might have been much less affected.
How long would it have taken for the Earth to cool down after a strike like that?
Yeah, that's really an excellent question. So we don't know exactly for how long, but some modeling suggests that these bad conditions might have lasted for years to decades.
And Nadia, where will your research take you next? Are you going to return to South Africa?
Yeah, so we are hoping to return to South Africa to do some more work because, you know, the effect of the S2 meteorite impact has been really interesting and frankly quite surprising to us. Right. So when we think about giant meteorite impacts, we think of, you know, the extinction of the dinosaurs. So we think of them as being really disastrous. But what our research is showing that there's really these positive side effects of these giant meteorite impact events. But what we want to do now, right, I've only looked at the S2 meteorite impact event, but there's like a number of other impact events that happened during that time period. So we want to go in and study those in much more detail to see if, you know, every meteorite impact had a similar effect or if there are some variations, right? Maybe some were more destructive, others were more beneficial. All of this really depends on a number of different factors. So you have to imagine that, of course, the size of the impactor matters, what type of impactor it was, what the environment was like, and of course, what life was doing at the time. So it would be really interesting to look at more impact events and see how those affected the environment and life. And then at the same time, you know, in this study, I've really largely focused on, you know, microbes in general, and then specifically on those that metabolize iron. So it'll be really interesting to also study other groups of microbes that maybe rely more on sulfur, for example, and see how those were affected by the impact event.
And Nadia, is there anything else that you'd like to add about your study and your research?
Yeah, so the area that we do research in is actually a World Heritage Site that is protected now because of its scientific significance, right? We can learn so much about Earth's deep past by looking at these rocks. So for that, I just like really want to thank the people that have allowed us to do research there and that have accommodated us so brilliantly.
Dr. Nadia Draben is an assistant professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Harvard University. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Everyday scientists get closer to more fully understanding Alzheimer's disease. A new series of national clinical trials will examine if benfotiamine, a synthetic version of thiamine, also known as vitamin B1, can be an effective treatment for mild cognitive impairment and early Alzheimer's disease. If successful, the trials could lead to a widely available, affordable treatment for Alzheimer's. To learn more, I spoke with the scientist behind the study. Dr. Gary Gibson is a professor of neurosciences at the Burke Neurological Institute, a medical research institute in White Plains, New York.
Since the 1930s, neurologists have known that vitamin B1 is very important for memory, both in humans and animals. And in the 1990s, people did studies of memory in Alzheimer patients and compared it to thiamine deficient humans. And there were a lot of similarities. So this stimulated us to think about thiamine in Alzheimer's disease.
Dr. Gibson says he and his team believed there's a link between Alzheimer's disease and thiamine. He and his team began conducting experiments on thiamine deficient animals.
And what you can do is, if you make a mouse model of Alzheimer's disease, if you make them thiamine deficient, you get an increase in plaques all over the brain. And plaques is one of the defining features of Alzheimer's disease. And also you get indications of tau, which is a tangle formation, another indicator. So this suggested that thiamine deficiency can drive plaque and tangle formation.
Dr. Gibson says that finding, that a thiamine deficiency could be linked to plaque and tangle formation in the brain, is very different than what he calls the dogma of the field. It's also different for how FDA-approved Alzheimer's drugs function.
The protein that makes up the plaque is called amyloid. And what Biogen and many other labs, most labs, try to do is get rid of that abnormal amyloid. What we're trying to do is block its formation to begin with.
Considering the finding that a lack of thiamine in the brain is linked to the plaque and tangles that are associated with Alzheimer's, could it be that boosting thiamine could prevent Alzheimer's disease? It may not be that simple, Dr. Gibson explains.
Thiamine itself is a very poor drug because it just raises thiamine a little bit. And there's no way to raise the, you can't do this with vitamin B1. And in the 1960s, to address a public health problem, the Japanese developed these compounds, these small molecules that increase thiamine far more in the blood, far more than you can ever do with thiamine itself. So what you can do with benfotiamine is increase blood thiamine 100 times normal.
Dr. Gibson says researchers in China gave benfotiamine to mice who were genetically engineered to make plaques in their brains. He said raising thiamine with benfotiamine can reduce plaques by 80%. His team wanted to see if the same treatment could benefit mice that were similarly genetically engineered to have tangles in their brains.
If you give them benfotiamine and raise thiamine, you diminish the tangles by 80%.
There are common uses of benfotiamine. Dr. Gibson says it's used to treat the peripheral neuropathy of diabetics, people who are thiamine deficient. Benfotiamine is readily available at health food and supplement stores, but Dr. Gibson warns that dietary supplements are not regulated by the FDA.
You can buy benfotiamine at a health food store. You don't know what that is, though. So our benfotiamine is made according to FDA standards at every step. It's very safe, and we know exactly what we're giving.
All of this is to say that Dr. Gibson believes the treatment should not be directed at the plaques and tangles linked to Alzheimer's disease, but instead the changes that occur before these things form in the brain. With preliminary data in hand, Dr. Gibson says his team began a pilot trial at Berk. The trial involved 35 patients who were given benfotiamine and 35 who were given a placebo.
And we treated them for 1 year, and the gold standard in Alzheimer's disease research is 18 months. This is a pilot, so it's a small number, and also it's a short duration. And in spite of that, on the primary clinical outcome measure, which is called ADAS-COG, there was a very large reduction in the worsening of that score. And it is larger than what's been published for lecanemab, the drug that is now available in the U.S.
Other cognitive majors, he says, also trended in the right direction. Dr. Gibson and his team presented their preclinical studies and pilot trial research to an Alzheimer's disease cooperative group at UC San Diego. ACDC helped secure a grant from the National Institutes of Health for Dr. Gibson and his team to expand their study.
So what the grant does is, one, it will increase the N. So in this trial, we'll have 406 patients. And it will increase the number of sites.
The goal is to have 50 sites by the end of the year. Previously, the plaques and tangles in the brains of Alzheimer's patients could only be detected with a PET scan. Dr. Gibson says new advancements have led to the signs of Alzheimer's to be detectable through a blood test.
And we'll be one of the first trials to use these blood tests at every step of the trial, so the patients don't have to do any PET scan.
And one more thing that Dr. Gibson says is unique about this study, it isn't being funded by the pharmaceutical industry.
This is all supported by NIH and also by the Alzheimer Drug Discovery Foundation. So I think it's remarkable that this can happen. What we have now is we call encouraging results. And what we hope to have with this trial is whether this is actually any good for Alzheimer's or not.
Dr. Gary Gibson is a professor of neurosciences at the Burke Neurological Institute. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. U.S. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer was in Albany in late October to celebrate news that New York's capital city is in line to become a national hub for semiconductor research. As WAMC's Samantha Simmons reports, the Albany Nanotech Complex has been selected as the first location for the National Semiconductor Technology Center.
I am proud to announce that America's first National Semiconductor Technology Center will be right here at Albany Nanotech.
The U.S. Department of Commerce says Albany will be home to the nation's first Chips for American Research and Development flagship facility. It's a major development for a region that has angled to become the nation's capital for the emerging technology. The Commerce Department and NatCast, the operator of the National Semiconductor Technology Center, says New York Creates Albany Nanotech Complex is expected to house the Chips for America Extreme Ultraviolet Accelerator. The EVU accelerator will be supported by $825 million in proposed federal funding. Schumer calls it a turning point for America.
The whole world will look right here, the capital region, to see the next developments in chip research, advanced chip research. NSTC will be the headquarters for the most advanced chip research, not just for the country, but for the whole world. China, we're not letting you catch up to us. That's what we're saying here, loud and clear.
The New York Democrat says the nearly $1 billion investment funded by the Chips and Science Act will bring good-paying jobs in leading companies to Albany. Schumer says this is only the beginning of federal funding. However, as the facility plants its feet as the federal headquarters for semiconductor research, it could attract billions in investments. Schumer says roughly 1,000 jobs are expected to be created as a result of the designation. The center is the first of three major NSTC facilities to be announced by the DOC. Dave Anderson, president of New York Creates, says the center has, quote, the most advanced technical capabilities, unquote, of any site in the country.
New York has made a 20-year-plus investment in semiconductor technologies. We've laid the foundation. We've put the capabilities in place to support next generations of technology.
Chips power everyday items from cell phones and cars to artificial intelligence. In 2020, a years-long chip shortage was triggered by the COVID-19 pandemic, causing panic in many industries and the economy. Governor Kathy Hochul, who has been a supporter of investing in chip manufacturers like Micron and Syracuse, which is expected to begin construction in 2025, says the designation makes Interstate 90 an innovation corridor for the state.
I'm declaring that right now. Because we are. leading the nation, but also leading the world as a global leader in manufacturing and semiconductor manufacturing.
The Democrat adds that the state recognizes the challenge of filling the positions for high-demand, high-paying jobs with local residents. She says the state is working to re-educate educators and ensure that computer science and STEM courses are being taught to more youth.
That's how you get that competitive advantage that I've said we will do. Also, I'm working on my State of the State address right now about college affordability and creating more pipelines of accessibility for these high-demand, high-paying jobs. We have 500,000 open jobs in the state of New York. But what I want to focus on is that underserved communities have access and a direct path to the high-paying jobs that are brought by this innovation right here today.
The Commerce Department says the accelerator will have initial operations available in 2025 and will allow state, federal, and industry researchers to, quote, conduct research and development activities essential to enabling faster commercialization of innovative semiconductor technology, unquote.
Today, the feds are stepping up to meet the moment, to make sure America stays on top, to make sure our future is stamped made in America, made in upstate New York, not made in China.
Samantha Simmons, WAMC News, Albany.
If you'd like to tell the best of our knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to the best of our knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit wamcpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1779. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Madeline Reynolds. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, WAMC.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.